Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us for what is going to be the best session of the day, right? Set that up right away out front. So who here has not yet been inspired by anything that they've experienced today? Any inspiration in the room? How's it going? Yeah, that's great. I have to share with you a session I went to this morning. There was a great quote that Carla Harris from Morgan Stanley used. The definition of fear is false evidence of things appearing real. And that really resonated with me, and so I thought I'd share that with you to start with. But the topic for this session is Women on Boards, and Korn Ferry is really proud to be a sponsor of this session. For those of you that are not familiar with Korn Ferry, we are a talent management firm. We work with organizations on linking their talent strategies to their business strategies. We focus on design, build, and attract. Many of you might be familiar with the attract piece because we've been a very successful large recruiting firm for over 45 years. But we're also a successful leadership and talent consulting firm. So if you are looking at doing talent reviews, succession planning, leadership development, competency modeling, really any aspect of your talent strategy, then that is something that Korn Ferry can help participate with. But one of the other things that Korn Ferry does is proprietary research through our Korn Ferry Institute. And we've left on the chair copies of the Tech 100 boards, Where Are the Women? Because that's part of the topic that we're going to be discussing today. And to get a sense of who's in the room, could you raise your hand if you happen to sit on a public board today? Okay. Sit on a private board? Okay. Nonprofit? Okay. And for those of you that have aspirations to sit on a public board, could you raise your hand for that? Okay. Lots of people here. That's great. Well, our esteemed panel today, they have all the answers to all the questions that you have. So I'll just tell you that right now. But we only have an hour, so we'll see how far we get. Jane Stevenson is the leader of our panel. She is the head of the CEO and board service at Korn Ferry. And just literally, she and Nadia Dumuni, who is a reporter with Thomson Reuters focusing on corporate governance, are going to report on some new research, which is just being published today, that is related to effectiveness, what boards are most effective for women. And then joining the conversation, we are very lucky to be joined by Jerry Elliott, former SVP at Juniper Networks. She's on the board of Whirlpool, Bed Bath & Beyond, and Charlotte Russe. And good friend, Mary Cranston, former managing partner of the Pillsbury Law Firm, who's on the boards of Juniper Networks, Visa, and AAA. And on the nonprofit front, she's on the board of the Catalyst Women's Leadership Organization. So she can also talk about the research that they do related to women on boards as well. So with that, Jane, where's the pipeline for women on boards?
Well,
take it away.
It's right here. So what we want to do is to have a really substantive conversation with you and have a little fun with it as well. And what we're hoping is that you'll learn some things that we've learned either through our expert panel or through the work that we've been doing recently. One of the things that happened right before coming in is we all were probably trying to use the ladies' room or the men's room. I had the good fortune to be in the men's room, and it was kind of interesting to listen to what people were saying about the differences between the men's room and the women's room. And I was trying to hurry because I knew I needed to get mic'd and get into this room, but then I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting conversation. And one person said it doesn't smell as good, and another person said... So there were a number of comments about that. And kind of an interesting insight, right? So today we want to go inside the boardroom. And about, 4 months ago, Nadia gave me a call and asked if I would participate in helping to think about an article that she was thinking about writing. And we decided that it wouldn't be just the ordinary article on how many women are on boards, right? How many of you have heard at least 10 times in the last 2 years that there aren't enough women on boards? Any of you? Okay, so I think we're pretty clear about that. So when Nadia reached out to me, I kind of made a decision personally, just because I get calls a lot from a lot of different avenues to make comments about a lot of things, that I really wanted to participate if I was going to spend my time in something that would really potentially make a difference. And so we conceived together that something that would be much more powerful than just talking about how many women are on boards and how many women should be on boards is what causes women to really have impact in the boardroom. And there are two pieces to that, particularly given that the audience today has a lot of you who are thinking about that you would like to be on a corporate board and getting ready for that. And so one of the things that we aspire to a lot in our society today is labels, right? We put out labels. If you are a woman, you could be X. And we say what the label is. Today we want to really get under the label, and we want to talk about how you can have impact on a board. And so if you're on a board, we hope that it will be very relevant, because it will be talking about the things that we heard when we talked to over a dozen people, mostly women, but a few men for good measure, about what really creates impact when women are on boards, and how does that potentially change the game. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. And to make it a little bit interesting, we thought we would build around some truisms that we hear all the time about women. And so we're going to have a quick highlight of some of the top lines for learnings from Nadia. And then we're going to just really dig into what some of the things are that came out as big themes and how they fit with the truisms about women.
So just not to reiterate what Jane was explaining, but essentially what we did is we spoke with a number of directors, on the most part on background, and in journalism that means not on the record. They haven't yet approved their quotes. So what we just did was have a candid conversation about what it's like to be sometimes the first female director in a boardroom. What does the discussion look like? A lot of the challenges that face these women, pretty much unanimously was the same. These are very powerful women, so their voices already are heard because they've delivered some confidence in the management ranks of the respective companies that they work for. But the most important thing that set these women apart from anybody, I guess some of the more junior people that we might talk to, is skills. And so what they said is you need to have experience. You need to show that experience, whether you're a man or a woman. You can't just depend on gender to get you into a boardroom. You have to be, try to move up the ranks. And it doesn't mean you have to be a CEO, but you just have to prove that you've got the board experience, that you know how to handle operations and P&L. And that's something that I think Jerry and Mary can talk about in detail. So we heard this, and it resonated that these women, some of them even said to us, hey, listen, we're at a point that we don't even need to take the first board seat anymore. There's a lot of women that don't want to take that challenge, but it was funny because there was about a 50-50 about from the interviews that we had. Some women were like, hell yeah, I want to take on the challenge of being the first director to deal with,
That's a woman.
To deal with, sort of elder, white, statesman type of gentleman.
And by the way, these were all women who were on multiple boards, because we wanted them to have a comparison of what worked better in one situation than another. And as you'll see, our two here today with Jerry and Mary are able to speak from a point of comparison.
So just to wrap this up very quickly, so I think it just shows a lot of these women are also talking about, as Hillary Clinton said, as well as Renee James from Intel, that we have to mentor other women. We have to make sure we reach out to women. And all the women that we spoke with actually said that they have gone much further than mentoring and sponsoring. They're actually guiding women, sitting down with them. So I think that's also an important point that we're hearing. So I think it's to the stereotype that women don't support each other. That's absolutely was thrown out in our research. So I think just to lead back over to you and the truism.
So one of the first truisms is you've come a long way, baby. So we were thinking, we've come a long way, baby, but you know what? In some ways, not so much. And so what we found was 100% of the women that we talked to were extremely, not marginally, extremely disappointed with the progress that we've seen thus far, and see a lot of opportunities for improvement. And not only that, feel that frankly, one board member is not enough. There's a saying that that I'm sure Jerry will probably comment on, but the number that kept coming up is when things started not to matter and really be based on the substance and the impact was three. When you have three women on a board, that seemed to be the number. But let's not listen to Nadia and I on that. Jerry and Mary, what are your thoughts on the pace of change and women taking seats on board?
Well, I think it's important to understand the numbers, and I'm a numbers person, so let's start with that. Depending upon who you believe, it's 17 to 18% of women are on the Fortune 500 boards. It's not much better on Fortune 1000. That's changed very smallly or gradually over the last few years. It's only up like 0.4%. Current course and speed says if we ever got to 30%, which seems to be a pretty good milestone, much less, is, of course, than 50%, but 30% would be huge. Current course and speed said it would take 33 years to get to 30%. Unless you do something incredibly drastic, and we'll talk about that in just a sec. That's the bad news. Now, why is that so? Well, one of your competitors, I won't mention their name, did a study that said that the number of board seats has gone down 12% since 2009. Boards are actually getting smaller, not larger. It used to be 10.8, the number of directors on a board. It's actually starting to go below 10 at this point in time. That's number one. Number two is, you know what the profile of a board director normally looks like. It's a sitting CEO or a retired CEO. When we think about it, we only have 25 women that are Fortune 500 CEOs. Pat just retired, so that was 26. So now, you know, we're back down to 25. Another stat, only 30%, depending upon who you believe, no disrespect to my pal here, but only 30% of board searches are done by a search firm. The other 70% is done from the network of folks that are already directors. Well, you see the chicken and the egg problem, right? If you're not already a public company sitting director and 70% are you know, nominated or referred by other directors, you got the chicken and the egg problem. That's the bad news, but I'm a glass half full kind of gal. So let me tell you the good news. The good news is that there are about a quarter of the directors so far of Fortune 500 are hitting the age 72. And 72, not in this panel right here, but 72 for the 75% of the Fortune 500 companies that have some sort of either term limit, age limit kind of thing, 72 is a magic number when most of them retire. So EY did a study that said over the next 5 years, they think that 27% of the board seats are going to turn over. That's a lot. That's a lot of opportunity. Right? And so there's the good news. So the Committee for Economic Development, who's looked at all these numbers, and it's a wonderful study. You should Google it and read the study itself. The Committee for Economic Development stated, which is a bipartisan organization, the oldest bipartisan organization in Washington, says that we should do what's called every other one. If every other director that's appointed in Fortune 500 or 1000 is a woman, we can get to that 30% in 4 years, not 33 years, okay? There's about 350, roughly 300 to 350 open seats every year. That's the turnover. If every other one we did 160, we could make huge progress. Make sense? So we have a lot of work to do.
Well, let me just say, I really want all of us to keep in mind that 30% is a bunch of bullshit. We are 50% of the economic force of this country, if not more.
Right.
And one of the things that you're seeing on boards is once they get to three women on the board, which in fact does make a difference in the boardroom. There's no question about it. It's almost like magic. The inability to be heard kind of goes away at that point. But that's not parity, and that's not really what this country needs. The problem is that once there are three women on the board, the majority male boards kind of take a deep breath. Okay, now we're in the safe harbor. So now we're going to go back to, as you said, the most logical next best candidate, which is the CEO pool, which, of course, is the most gender-biased pool on earth. So I think we've really got to change the whole calculation. And one other pernicious effect of this one-third safe harbor, is that actually is one-third for diversity of all stripes. Mm-hmm. And if you lump gender with ethnic minority groups and people of color, all of a sudden you have especially women of color in a very disadvantaged position, because in that one-third they'll be trying to cram African-American men and Hispanic men and white women. Mm-hmm. And if we went the other way instead and instead said gender is actually something that is not diversity, we have more women coming out of colleges now than men, 50% of the Fortune 500 executive positions are women, gender is actually the way it should look, you know, 50-50 at least, then all of a sudden women of color become a twofer. They bring the female persuasion to the board and also the diversity that's being looked for. So I think we really need to look at this very seriously and change the whole rhetoric. One other thing that's going on in the U.S. right now that is really hurting the increase in women on boards, because the United States is actually really stuck. In Europe, they're making a lot of progress with quotas, and in England, there's an old boys network challenge to each other to get up to 30 or 40% women on the boards, and it's making a difference. We're going backwards in large part because so many of our companies are under activist challenge. And the game plan right now with short-term activists is to challenge a company and trade a few board seats for victory. Mm-hmm. And the slates that the activists are putting up, I can guarantee you, are virtually all white men. Mm-hmm. And so many of the open seats that are coming available are hoovered up by this particular dynamic.
You know what's interesting, just to bounce off what Mary was saying, is I don't know if people are familiar in here what happened with Darden, the restaurant chain, and they had a shareholder activist that came in and completely nominated an entirely new slate. So there's 12 new directors on that board. But interestingly enough, in those directors were, I believe it's four women, one African-American male, and the rest are white gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because it was based on skills. So all people did when they were voting in these directors were basically looking at their skills and saying, okay, well, regardless of gender, this woman is completely skilled, this man is completely, this is how it, so they formed that board, and it just shows, obviously, that, you know, depends on skills, but you can still have
Well, I think boards that are kind of being, when you're trying to run a proxy fight for a whole board, that is a very, very unusual situation, and a positive outcome for the challenger is unlikely. So really, that company was pretty smart, because Darden, you know, the challenger was pretty smart, because they went to what I would call a best practices model to put together a board that might have been strong enough, in fact was, to challenge the incumbent. But unfortunately for most of these are little backroom deals where they don't change out the board. You avoid a proxy fight by agreeing to put two new directors on, almost always white men.
So I think this goes to our next truism, where I'm sure all the ladies in the room have heard from men, why can't we just leave things the way they are? I mean, why are we fighting over these things? So, I mean, that's one thing that we've all heard from husbands, men in our lives, maybe, who knows, but fathers. So really, I think the important thing here is overcoming the trust factor. And having women on boards, especially some of the ones that we spoke with, the first-timers that decided to get on a board, they said, you know, in some cases it took months for the men to actually understand, you know, where the woman is coming from. And sometimes, in some cases, we heard from women who actually bonded with other female directors on the board because they couldn't at first get their point across, but it took a while. And we heard the same with minorities. There was one gentleman we heard from Indian descent. It took him about 12 to 13 months for the rest of the board to actually understand where he was coming from, where his opinions were coming from. So, but then it does create change. And I think that's an important point. What do we mean by change? Why does the discussion change? So, I mean, we've heard, you know, the old men going to play golf, and they're just the old boys club, and we heard that time and time again. So really all these people coming onto the boards are actually shaking things up. And I think that's something maybe what Mary and Jerry can talk about is how does the discussion in the boardroom change once a person of a different gender or ethnicity or race actually comes on the board?
Well, you know, I think this is a really important point, and I think most what we're dealing with is unconscious bias. It's not necessarily malicious. It's unconscious. And white men are actually at a pretty significant disadvantage to even being able to pick it up. Because their whole perspective is, if there's a power white male in the room, their conditioning is to pay attention to that person. And they have no idea that they're not paying as much attention to other people in the room. Women, of course, because we're always the one who is ignored, we pick it up instantly. And our problem with the same, we all carry the same biases, men and women. We carry them as self-doubt. Men carry it as an inability to really pick up the woman's contribution. So most of the women who get into the major boards are pretty skilled at this. I mean, they would not have gotten to where they are with the credentials to get on the board by being shrinking violets who have no clue how to deal with male-dominant groups. Nonetheless, the boardroom is a particularly concentrated place of classic male behavior because they're mostly men, they're mostly successful men, and they're used to, at that level of business, relating to each other. So it's actually kind of extreme when you first go in there as a female. I do like boards with three because with three smart women, you can fix that problem pretty quickly. But if you're the only one, you have to use your skills. And I'm sure almost everybody in this room would know some of the techniques you use. And and in the boardroom, like in top levels of business, there is a narrower range of behavior on the part of women that is perceived as helpful and unshrill. And so, you know, you just have to kind of operate that way. My own experience on boards is, because of the bias that I know is there, I tend to go in there and I'm kind of quiet for a little while I get the lay of the land. Then I start doing things by figuring out who's kind of the most persuasive people in the boardroom. And if I have an idea, I'll start working the side conversations with that person. And then gradually pick it up. And, you know, in every board I've been on, pretty soon I get to be in a leadership position. I tend to want to grab the nominating slot if that's available because that is a position in which you can influence the gender diversity of the board.
And Mary, is there anything like a personal example when you were first getting on your first board where something really helped to change that momentum?
Well, you know, honestly, you also are on the board because you have some particular set of skill sets that they've recognized is important. And in my case, I was a lawyer. Now, that is not normally what board members want to see, but I was fortunately a CEO of a law firm, so that kind of allowed me to get on the boardroom. But the first company that they chose me because I was a female CEO, but I was on the board about 3 weeks when they got indicted by the federal government for price fixing, and I was an antitrust specialist. All of a sudden, I became the most important person in the boardroom. So a crisis that plays into your skill set can be very, very critical to your dominance in
core
that room.
Competency.
Yeah,
this is an important point, though. You know, we laugh, but this came up over and over again. And sometimes adversity is our best friend. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a point very much worth noting.
What about you, Jane? Can I just say one last point? Sure. I know I'm dominating on this particular point, but I think it's one of the critical ones. If you understand the male behavior, that they are actually just cross-referring to each other and they don't see you, it's there are a lot of things you can do, including, credentialing yourself on the topic that's being discussed with a factual story about something you did that was a critical turnaround point for the topic under discussion. Mm-hmm. Never, you would never say, I'm the world's greatest cost cutter. Instead, you'd say, you know, I had that same problem, and we were actually able to get about 40% out of the IT budget by bringing in Blumpty Blump, the consultant, you know, and whatever it is, some story that shows that you have done it, then that is yeah, that will credential you in that area, in that boardroom. And it's a simple trick
Just to add on to Mary's point, so some of the women that we spoke with also said that they would research the hobbies of some of the male directors. So if, for instance, we spoke with someone who is on a UK board and she made sure to know all the teams, the football teams, the soccer teams that each director was a fan of, and then was able to speak intelligently about football, and all of a sudden they thought, oh, she's one of us.
I would not go that far.
Okay, wow. So I guess it depends on the woman, but, I think it's also good to really familiarize yourself with the other directors, male or female, regardless. So, Jerry, I think you wanted to get it.
No, I wanted to go back to your actual the question that you posed, which is, why do things have to change? And I think it's important that you all arm yourself with the studies that have been done. We don't need another study done. Quite honestly, we've had more than enough. But you should know them. Credit Suisse, Chubb, Catalyst has done it twice.
McKinsey.
Bloomberg has done it. McKinsey's done it.
Stanford Business School.
Exactly. Where they've looked at diverse boards, diverse management teams as well, but diverse boards. They've looked at them over long periods of time. Chubb's study was over 6 years, where they were able to say if the board were diverse, it could mean anything from the lowest number I saw was a 16% difference, positive to the positive, in terms of return on equity, invested capital, and sales, all the way to 66%, depending upon the time frame and the companies they looked at. That's the reason why it has to change. It's good for business. It's not a matter of gender equality for gender equality. These are businesses. You talk about their bottom line and you get some attention.
And I think the reason, the men, when they're relating to each other, do get into a kind of alpha dog group think. And when you have other people in the room, especially when there's a critical mass, so that you actually can get your points in, it starts to open up new horizons, new opportunities, new thoughts.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the directors that we talked to actually came to the table with a mathematical formula that I'll arm you with, because I thought it was extremely compelling. It's the first time I've heard it. Which is to say that if half at least of the workforce is female and the intelligence quotient of women is the same as the intelligence quotient of men, and you don't have 50-50 women and men, mathematically you don't have the best talent in the room. I thought that was one of the best things I've heard in a long time, because it's just so logical, right? I mean, if you take the smartest group of people that's available and you only use 19% of them and you're filling the other 31% of the slots, per se, right, with people that aren't as capable, even by a simple measure like IQ. So, well, one of the other things that that comes up a lot with us as women is there's always a phobia when we say, you know, we need to talk, right? One of the things that we found in the boardroom is that that is actually a huge asset that that actually distinguishes women. And what we heard from both men and women is that when women are in the boardroom, that there's a lot more transparency. They tend to be very solution-focused and to think about the issues from the long term. It was interesting, in the session this morning with John Gray and Barbara Innes, they actually talked about some research that showed that just neurologically we are wired to think differently and longer term than just focuses on the near term. But we'd love to hear, you know, what has your experience been there, and do you see more willingness to dialogue when there's more women on the boards?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I've been on 6 public boards over time, so I have a lot of different experiences, and some of them have had 1 woman, 2 women, 3 women. It is my experience that women, for one thing, in order to get to a senior position in the United States as a female in a gender-biased world, you have to have some connectivity skills and some EQ that the average guy doesn't have to develop. So when you go into that boardroom, you're much more likely to be able to put the pieces together. There's also a lot of research on the brains of women that our ability to multitask and to see interconnections is more developed than men's. So that's a key skill within the boardroom. So when you combine EQ with the kind of brain that actually pretty easily gets out of the box and sees interconnections, you can be very powerful in the boardroom. And that's been my experience. Now, the cultural bias out there is that, as Catalyst puts it, the bias is men take charge, women take care. So we're seen as natural team builders, but not natural strategists and leaders. Turns out that is absolutely not true. But that is the bias carried by both men and women. So when a woman gets in a boardroom, usually there will be actually at the beginning an underestimation about how good she's going to be. And so I see over and over again that a woman is selected, gets in the boardroom, and then really blows people away and is pretty much the favorite director going forward. So one thing I would say to all of you is absolutely do not doubt your ability to be of use and help in that boardroom. I think our natural skill sets, what we had to go through to get where we are today, make us really invaluable. And also, once you're in the boardroom, especially if you get the nominating and governance slot, you not only can bring other women on the board, but also take a much greater interest in the pipeline within the company and become a real force for good, for opening up the opportunities for women in the leadership funnel. And many companies, when women start to do that from the board side, the pipeline is so pathetic. And it's really simple, with the right attention and the right pressure, to make sure the company, in very short order, identifies its highest performing women and gets them in a much better pipeline position.
I go back to when I was searching for my first public board. And one of the questions I would ask every board that I interviewed with was, I know you have a CEO succession plan. That's your job to do, one of the key responsibilities that a board does. Do you have a board succession plan? And if they said no, I knew it was a board that I probably didn't want to join. The good ones will have a board succession plan where they could answer the question for you, what do you think this board ought to look like in 5 years? In 10 years, because it takes about that long to turn over your board, maybe longer. And what I was looking for was I wanted a plan that said, I think I need this diverse set of skills on my board to make this company successful. And it might be marketing skills, it might be operational skills, it might be tech skills, whatever it is. There's no wrong answer, right? It depends on the particular company. But to ask, I give you that question. There were 14 questions, by the way, that I asked. And I asked every single board that I interviewed for. That was number one. Because I wanted to know if they thought about the fact that diversity of thinking will get them to a better answer. And were they thoughtful about the types of skill sets that they needed to make that company successful? You think about the value proposition that each and every one of you can bring to the table in that conversation. And I was on another panel recently where one of the gals said, make it no more than three, the power of three. Oh, there's three things that I want to be known for. I want to be branded for. And know what that is. Have that elevator pitch in your head, and make sure that that's how somebody can see you in terms of the value proposition you bring to that board. Because you have to be able to answer the question, why put you on this board? Why would the shareholders want you on this board? And what value can you provide to the company itself?
Yeah. It gets back to the impact. Just out of curiosity, let's just see how many of you here have current P&L accountability? So quite a few. Really, really helpful relative to the board equation. How many of you bring a background relative to marketing or
social media,
digital channels. So, okay, these are areas. Cybersecurity, IT relative to. Okay, so these are areas that are real pain points for boards.
Absolutely.
Today, and where
Absolutely.
You can find that intersection between those and really understanding the business strategy and the governance strategy, and you've had actual experience where you can speak in the boardroom, that's what they're talking about. And
yeah.
really
they're
starts
looking
to
for global responsibility.
Yep.
Geo responsibility. If they're expanding into Asia as an example, or EMEA, have you done an assignment there? Do you understand what's happening in social media right now, or marketing right now? Do you understand what's happening in digitalization and mobilization, security, given all that's happening? These are really hot topics for boards right now.
Is this resonating for you guys? Do you have questions as we go through? If you have some questions by area, then we'll go ahead and...
So first, I think you should decide for yourself what kind of board do you want to be on. There's the Fortune 500, there's the Fortune 1000, and then there's the other 4,000 public company boards in the United States, and then there's the plethora of private. Make a decision for yourself where you want to go target, because it will make a difference in terms of the value you can provide to that board and your competitiveness to get on that board. And there's a school of thought that says it's a hell of a lot more fun to be on a private board than it is to be on a public board. But you decide. That's your decision to make, right? Once you decide that, say that you want to get on a 500 or a 1,000. Look, if you don't have a C in your title, and it could be chief of anything, quite frankly, or report to the CEO. You know what we talked about what the normal profile is. But C in your title, or you report to the CEO, you've had not only operating experience, but P&L experience. Maybe you're a specialist in a particular area, whether it's marketing or tech, whatever it is, right? Again, that's the type of profile folks look for, because remember, Fortune 500 and 1,000, they're putting somebody on their board where they hope their shareholders go, good choice, right? Maybe there's a pop in the stock because of it. So it's about your brand, what you want to be known for. And when they write the press release that says Mary got on the board, was that a good thing? That they think that was a positive PR thing? Smaller companies and private companies, a lot different.
You know,
does that help a little bit? A
couple things to add. Finance skills are always needed on a board, and it's a counter-stereotype credential for women. So if you can somewhere along your career really learn some finance skills and add it to the mix, it's extremely helpful.
M&A as well,
M&A
right?
is good, too.
Depending on if the company's acquisitive,
yeah.
That's huge. GCs, we've got some GCs and their general counsels in the room. 25% of the Fortune 500 GCs are women, and they're only 5% on Fortune 500.
Now, they unfortunately suffer from the lawyer discrimination problem. So I coach a lot of women GCs who want to get on boards, and we really work a lot on expanding their responsibilities so that a GC job is one of those jobs that can be broad or narrow. And so you should definitely keep trying to add to the experience set. One area that is very hard to get on to boards from is the HR space. Is that fair? I don't think so, because talent management is so critical. But it's...
We're seeing more of it, actually.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing more of it. I mean, I think one of the rules of thumb that we have to deal with is from a governance perspective, people tend to think in terms of not putting someone on their board that they could hire. In other words,
that's why
if
the
you
lawyer
can hire
problem.
The expertise, so just being a strong lawyer or just being a strong marketer or just... So this is where you have to think in terms of that juxtaposition. And what we're looking for here is the advice. We're looking for the advice that provides supervision and governance of leadership on behalf of the shareholders. Mm-hmm. And so when you think of it from that standpoint, as you think in terms of preparing and as you think in terms of how women had impact, that way we heard a lot of examples of where that played in, right, Nadia?
Yeah, I think so. But I think just to go back to what Jerry and Mary were saying and to the point that the question that you were asking, I think there's also the big question of how do I first get into a boardroom of a Fortune 500 company. Who do I speak with? Who's in my network? I think that's one of the most important things that both came out of our interviews and through interviewing both of you. Some of you said you're on for-profit, boards, and some of you said private equity or private companies. There's a very mixed view on both, whether you start on private companies or for profit. And I think it'd be good for you two to weigh in on it, because we've heard very mixed views about that.
Yeah, let me just kind of back up a minute. What is the key skill here to getting onto a board? Aside from your resume and your credentials, it's networking, period. Yeah. Simple. And women, there's a lot of research on this, women under-network compared to men. Because we have built into us a kind of a notion that the friendship is a little more full service than guys. They have what I would call kind of shallow networks sometimes. They're very quid pro quo. Women have to train themselves. And when McKinsey interviewed the top 50 women CEOs in the United States about what their key skill sets were that allowed them to get to the top in male-dominated environments, one of the five patterns they identified was learning to network like a guy. So networking comes in all parts of your life. And it, fortunately today with modern technology, it's easier than it used to be. But whenever I want to get on a board, I start doing what I call a network map, which is I kind of figure out who I know on the board or who I know in the industry who might be able to get me to meet some people that might open a door. It's that kind of stirring the pot that ultimately opens it up. you have to be realistic about your credential set. I mean, if you're a mid-level executive in a startup, you're probably not going to be asked to be on a Fortune 100 board, no matter how much networking you do. But if you, once you're realistic about that, it does take a lot more networking than people think. Mm-hmm. And especially for lawyers and others that are not really able to use the headhunter network too effectively. You know, you've got to do this networking. The other thing is what is the advantage of a nonprofit board, especially if it's kind of a big ticket one? I mean, one of the best boards I was ever on was a 10-year trustee at Stanford. That's a heavy hitting board. Mm-hmm. I made some great friends, and anybody you're on a board with, you actually become a friend. It's a much tighter networking bond than almost anything else you could do. And there are a lot of boards that do have community leaders and business leaders on them. And it's a great place for you to get there. They watch you, and then they can become an advocate for you into the places you need to go. The actual experience of being on a nonprofit board will never be seen by a public company as giving you the relevant experience. So the real advantage to this nonprofit board is that it gives you a better network. And the same thing with private company boards. A lot of those are venture-backed or private equity-backed, and many of those individuals who sit on those boards have broad networks. And so the key is to really learn how to work those folks to help open doors for you. And my experience with it is it was really hard at first because I just was not comfortable asking men to do things for me. And I just made myself do it. And a couple of surprises. One was it got easier because I kind of learned some techniques that worked. But also, people really do try to help. It's amazing. It's amazing. And my experience is if I was trying to get on a board and I stirred the pot and I stirred it long enough, things would happen. If I wasn't stirring the pot, nobody ever knocked on my door. So I think, you know, that if I have one piece of advice for people, it's, you know, in addition to getting your resume in position so that you are, you know, you've got the credentials that would be considered, it's to learn this skill set of networking.
That's, so I have 8 pieces of advice for you. That one is number one. Because I always tell the story, when I couldn't be on a board early in my career. IBM wouldn't allow us. Microsoft said you can do it if you're not a customer or a competitor. Okay. That was like 99% of the companies out there. And so it's late in my career that I decided to get on a board. And I thought if I just told my little small circle of, you know, a handful of close friends, that magic would happen. And I would get the phone call. And it didn't. Crickets happened for about 6 months until I realized that I had to put a plan in place to go after a board just the same way I would go after an operating role if I wanted to. So I had this 8, I won't take you through all 8, but I had this 8 things that I did. The first and foremost was to figure out what my value proposition was. Mm-hmm. Again, have that in your head, that story. Take stock of your achievements, your accomplishments, and know what they were. The second thing I did is I went to my CEO and my board. Mary was on the board of Juniper at the time, and went to my board and said, will you support me? Will you help me get on a corporate board? And I'm telling you, you got to do that first versus later in the process, because it's been very embarrassing to go down a process and almost get on a corporate board and find out that your CEO doesn't think that's such a great idea. So you go do that now versus later. The third thing I did is I presented to this my board every opportunity I got. For the last 15 years, I've probably been at every board meeting of my company, either attending it or presenting it. We were lucky that we had CEOs that like management and the board to come together. And why did I do that? Because when I'm sitting in the interview and the CEO says, well, tell me about the board experience you had. And of course, I had nonprofit as well. Don't get on a nonprofit unless your heart's truly in it, because they'll suck you dry in terms of money and resources. And I had private. I had a lot of private boards. But I could answer I could say, I've attended every board meeting the last 15 years. I know what my board talked about. I was in the room and I know what's important to them. And that was a big difference. And then I asked my board to be my references, because the references that you have to land an operating role are different than the references you would have to land a public board.
And frankly, having seen her for all those years, I could say with a total straight face, she's CEO material.
Mm-hmm.
And she would have been CEO if she wanted to stay around. You know?
So just very quickly, because I know we're going to run out of time soon. So one thing that women also get accused of is overthinking. And what you've just drawn out here is all the homework that women do. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's, and I think that's the number one advice, aside from what you two have provided, that we've heard as well, is make sure that when you're joining a board that you do all your homework about the culture of the company, the CEO, the management team, the other directors on the board, which we've all talked about. And I think women, as from what we've heard from our interviews, probably do much more homework than the men do. And both
Absolutely.
When they get on the boards too, yeah. there's a lot more due diligence. You go around the operations, you want to walk around and see everything for yourself. So I think maybe if you want to tell the audience what this homework entails, both pre-joining a board and once you get on a board.
Okay, well, if I'm looking at a company, I will definitely read the 10K from soup to nuts, and I'll really put together a very comprehensive set of strategic questions that I would have if I were on that board. When I'm preparing for a board, when I first get on a board, I insist on at least a 2-day orientation where I really try to get my head into the company. Because the worst thing you want to do is look like a lightweight on the basic business. But the good news is, with all the experience you have, if you give 3 days of study to a company, you will be able to figure it out. It's never that much rocket science. And so that's, and then of course being prepared in the boardroom is very critical because, again, the bias against women is that you're a nice team player, but you're not strategic. So if you actually slip up, especially in the first year, and are not prepared, you're going to pay a price that's going to take you a long time to dig your way out of that hole. Let me just say the last thing about prepping, this has less to do with the substance and more to do with our own heads. Because, as I said, these biases are carried in our heads as self-doubt. And when you get into the top level of a company, particularly with a real alpha dog board, there's a lot of opportunity for self-doubt to creep up. So you really have to have the self-awareness to let that little voice yammer on and still stay in a fairly centered place where you can hear what's going on, you can use your good EQ skills to read, and you're not kind of going into a defensive, contracted mode because it's a little scary. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the skill set that I, over in my own life, I've identified as probably the most critical for every woman leader, because we all carry these fears in our heads. And I can tell you that it's there's a lot out there now that can actually help you with these things. It's a little bit like cognitive intervention, where you literally start to watch your mind instead of just be your mind. And in a boardroom, it can become quite critical, especially if the company's under stress. Because in that situation, if it's mostly men, they will go into a very heightened, aggressive mode, and it becomes even more difficult as a female to be effective. But if you can stay centered, you can do so much good in that environment. It actually calms everybody.
We had quite a few hands raised for questions, and we need to we'll make that the time to answer our last few questions, if you would like. I know you had a question over there. And then we'll try to wrap up here in the next.
Oh yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because everybody's worst fear is that you have to go to some gargantuan ballroom filled with men and walk around trying to make small talk. No. What I'm talking about is literally you start from your goal in networking. So it's not you and the world, it's you with a goal, and then you really spend some time figuring out who you know and who knows people who might know, things that could help you achieve your goal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I first started looking for a board, I put together a resume, and I went and saw a couple of my female friends that had been on boards for a while, and we just sat down and went over my resume. So that was one piece of the networking. Mm-hmm. And of course, they then knew I was interested, and, you know, so they kind of had their ears out. I mean, it just all starts to snowball. And for example, if you're interested in going on the board of an industry, just figure out who you know in that industry and start talking to them about what are the challenges, what are the best players, who's the winner, who's the loser in the industry, and start to become really knowledgeable about it. That would be another piece of the networking. So it's all stuff that you can think of if you give yourself time to sit down and get quiet and go beyond the first thing that pops into your head. It's amazing what giving yourself 2 hours, don't let yourself get up until your network map has been thought about for 2 hours, and you would be amazed at, you know, kind of where that will take you.
And here's something that that we see a lot, and it's kind of off the record, if you will. But there's an orientation to overcoming the trust factor that has to really kick in. Because when you're on a board, you meet 5-6 times, could be 4 times even, some boards, probably no more than 8. And once you're in a boardroom, it's a lot harder to get someone out of a board position. Mm-hmm. And so directors tend to want to go with people that are known commodities. We even have boards that say, we want you to vet out candidates, but we want to have some frame of reference to knowing this person already. What does that mean? That means then that if we're outside that circle, we have to overcome the trust factor. That's my Jainism. But it's just a way to say it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I think Mary and Jerry are saying, if I can dare speak on their behalf, I think is there's an understanding of who is in the boardroom and how do you get to know and create a level of confidence between you and they. That's what Mary and Jerry both talked about having done. I'm saying it in very simple terms, but that's a really important point. We have, I know, overrun what people were anticipating for the time, for the day, but why don't we take, we'll just take one last question here, and then we'll try to wrap it up.
It depends on the board.
Can I give a simple answer on that? I think one of the things to look for is, does the board of the private company have legal accountability? A lot of private company boards are really advisory boards. They don't set them up like that, and they generally are willing to pay you the same. But what you need to understand is, does the CEO serve at the behest of the board?
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
If the CEO does not, then it is an advisory board. I know that's being overly simplistic, mm-hmm. but that's kind of the rubber meets the road. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do an advisory board necessarily. It just means you need to understand whether this board really has the mandate from a, you know, from a real governance standpoint, or whether it is the advisory group that the CEO and the leadership team is going to use to guide the company.
And it does depend on the company itself, and at what stage are they in? If they're early startup or late stage or mature, or they're about to go IPO. I am on one private board, and we run ourselves exactly as if we're a public company with the same governance structure that we have in our public companies.
I guess one main difference, though, is the public board fiduciary duties and the legal responsibilities are heightened. And the liabilities are heightened.
Yep.
So you have to know a lot more, and I definitely think it's worth investing in a director college if you're thinking about going on public boards, because there's a whole lore that you need to learn.
And there's lots of great education. That is one of the steps I tell you to absolutely do long before you get on a public board, is go get some director education, formal director. There's lots of them right here in the Bay Area. You'd be surprised how better an interview you will have once you're educated.
But there are a network of women. Would you like to suggest some of the groups of women that perhaps they can try to reach out to? I don't know if it's the Committee for Economic Development, maybe is one of the groups.
No, Committee of Economic Development is a bipartisan organization. Okay, it just happened to have done the study. There's lots of paid membership organizations that, depending upon if you're already on a board or not, might be appropriate. There's a Silicon Valley Directors Exchange right here. I would just tell you, whether it's Deloitte or EY or Stanford has a Directors College or a Directors Consortium, Northwestern has a Women's Directors College,
NACD,
Duke has one,
programs.
UCLA has one. Go get yourself trained before you decide whether you want to get on a public board or not.
I would actually not recommend that you spend a lot of time networking with other women who would like to be directors, as if you think that's the path that's going to get you on a board. I would definitely go more with my network mapping strategy than that. And I think I have run into a lot of women, because it is a little scary, who just kind of like to hang out with other women who like to talk about getting on boards. And I've just gotten to the point where I want to say, let's just call this off and you guys go home and do your homework, you know?
So in closing, the last thing that we'll just throw out as kind of a challenge and an opportunity mutually for all of us is, you know, there's a truism that women don't like to help other women. And the reality is that in 30 years of doing this work myself and in the deep dive conversations that we've had and what you've heard today, I think that's patently false.
I agree.
And the reality is that there is a huge commitment on the part of women who have pioneered to actually ensure that it becomes easier for the next generation.
Amen.
And so I think that's a kind of an inspiring thought for us to join together in. And there's a piece of advice that that I gave a few years back to a Fortune 500 CEO who's a woman, so that limits it to 25. We were talking for quite a bit of time, and I was coaching her, and I said, you know, it would be much more inspiring if instead of wanting to become a CEO, you really wanted to build a great company. And when she became CEO, she actually quoted that in the Wall Street Journal, which was a neat thing. But I want to leave you with a similar challenge today. It's one thing to want to, quote, be on a board. It's another thing to really aspire to have governance impact on an organization that can help to transform the economy, to transform the lives of the people that are employees in that organization, and to create wealth on behalf of the business and the shareholders. I think that's a really worthy goal, and what we hope today that we've laid out for you are some things that you could really use to, instead of just wanting to be on a board, don't want you not to want to be on a board, but to really want to make a difference. Because what could be worse than not having enough women on boards is having women who aren't committed to the right things to really create change and impact in the business world. And that's what we'll leave you with today.
That's great.
Thanks.
That's great. Well said. That is really